Hi, everybody. Dana here, and Chelsea and I are super excited to kick off season 8 with Cole Arthur Riley. Cole is coming out with her second book right now, Black Liturgies, Prayers, Poems, and Meditations for Staying Human. It's based on her Instagram social media account, Black Liturgies. If you're not familiar with this, please go check it out and definitely pick up a copy of her book. Cole is the creator of Black Liturgies, which is a space that integrates spiritual practice with Black emotion, Black literature, and the Black body. Cole is a writer, a poet, an activist, a theologian, and she just has so many amazing things to offer in this very thoughtful and intentional conversation. We hope you enjoy this. We're kicking off season 8, and please check this out.
Welcome to season 8. We are so excited to kick off this season where we'll be talking to some of our favorite authors. And one of our absolute favorite authors, poets, theologian, activists, Cole Arthur Riley, is with us to kick off this season. Cole, welcome. We are so excited to talk with you about your new book, Black Liturgies, Prayers, Poems, and Meditations for Staying Human. Cole, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to see you. We are so excited to hear about this book and what it has to offer, what you're looking for.
So let's kind of dive in. So this year, Flesh came out 2 years ago. And now you're back with this this new book all about liturgy and has poems and prayers and letters and quotes. What was your goal, your purpose, your mission in writing this book? Like, what was your kind of hope for it?
Yeah, I mean, I started Black Liturgies, you know, the online project, like 3.5 years ago now. And I'm very aware that I would not have had the opportunity to write This Here Flesh in the way that I did had I not had that community and that kind of platform. And I think most people thought that Black Liturgies would be kind of my first book, and I have been very fortunate that that community has just been incredibly patient with me and kind of received This Here Flesh with open arms, even though it is so different than the project they came to know me from. And so with Black Liturgies, the book, I really wanted to take the time to just honor that community and honor that space that I think really has been collectively generated the past 3.5 years. And so there's, you know, written prayers included, but there are also letters from me that kind of mirror some of the posts that I might share, a few of my own thoughts, a few sentences. I've expanded that into kind of a letter to preface each section, and of course incorporated a lot of, you know, rich wisdom from the ancestors, from Black ancestors, to kind of ground each section. Yeah.
Did you have an idea when you started Black Liturgies 3 years ago that would morph into a book? Or was this really something that you separated until there was kind of space to think about it?
Yeah, I mean, when I started the project online, it never really crossed my mind that it could ever transform into a book. I had just a very small imagination for what that space would even become. And so a book was very far from me. But, you know, as I've gone on and shared so much in kind of the like transient space of online, you do kind of get a craving for something physical, for something tangible. There's a different kind of agency, I think, you feel over a tangible book that that you just don't have in the same way that you have in like a virtual space where, you know, social media giants can really decide who sees what, who holds what, and when. So I mean, I'm glad that it's developed into kind of a physical artifact as well.
That's such an interesting reflection, is the book has become the tangible physical connection to, you're right, like the virtual space.
Mm-hmm.
I really like
that. I mean, even when I'm listening to like an audiobook, I like to have the physical too. Like I like to underline and highlight, and like I always need like both hands, right? So yeah. Mm-hmm. But Cole, you have such like, I'm sure you've heard this before, but like an old soul. Like there's so much wisdom when I'm reading your writing, and the way you put words together is just, it unleashes a new imagination for me with spirituality. It makes me see things in a new light. Were you always a writer? Was this like, is this a cultivated practice for you? It feels to me like you have always been, you know, like this wisdom provider. Yeah.
You know, it does feel that way to me to some extent, that I've always been a writer. When I mean, my family jokes that when I was little, I wrote more than I spoke, because I was not a very verbal child at all. And writing for me was kind of my first real form of connection with the exterior world. I was pretty withdrawn and only really spoke to my sister, my father, and a few family members that lived with us. And if I was in public, I would like jot things down on a notepad to tell people, you know. And it took me a long time to kind of grow out of that way of being. And I think writing was a huge portal, a huge kind of portal out of myself and into connection with other people. I will say I haven't always been, you know, a spiritual writer, I would say. That is not something I think I could have predicted. You know, I wasn't raised in an overtly Christian home. And even in college, when I began to kind of enter Christian tradition, it didn't really overlap with the writing I was doing in the classroom. I studied writing at Pitt, and there was really no overlap at all. I kept the page far away from the pew in that sense. There were no allusions to God or anything like that, really, in the writing I was doing. And Black liturgies, I mean, and maybe a year before that in some of the work I was doing, but Black liturgies is really the first attempt at sharing kind of writing that's connected to the divine in a public way.
So can you take us back and talk to us about how Black liturgies, for those who may not be familiar, there might be some, but even for those that are familiar, how did it come about? Where does the name come from? How did you, and then what was it like getting into that spiritual writing? Was that something that you just felt you needed to connect to? Where did it come from?
So I began Black Liturgies, the digital project, the summer of 2020. And it was, you know, of course, in the wake of like a slew of Black murders at the hands of white people, Elijah McClain, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd. And there was this particular momentum, I think, in media and in the kind of public eye to pay attention a little bit more than it typically does to Black death. And it awakened, I think all of us were kind of reckoning either with, you know, realizing for the first time, which I think a lot of white people maybe were realizing the violence against Black bodies for the first time and having to witness it on a recording, and then for Black people having to deal with white realization of Black pain, it made everything louder. And I think a lot of Black people looked around and realized that they, you know, had real comfort and harbor in the spiritual spaces that they were in. And I think a lot of Black people looked around and realized, you know, we weren't as safe as we thought we were in the religious spaces that we occupied, the churches that we occupied. And I, for my part, had already grown to love the kind of Episcopal liturgical tradition. I love the writing. I love the kind of beauty of the liturgy. I love not having to think of anything to say on the spot. And having this kind of form decided for me. But I will say the summer of 2020 was one of those seasons where, you know, I say it's just particularly difficult to pray words written by a white man. And so I started Black liturgies out of that real hunger and a real lack, I think, in the spaces that I was in to meet and to speak to Black grief and Black joy and, you know, the Black body in a way that felt honest, you know. So I began sharing these little snippets of prayers and connecting them to, you know, Black wisdom tradition and sharing them, and that online community grew pretty quickly. Yeah.
You've used this word, and it's in the title of your book, but liturgy, it might be a foreign word to people that don't grow up in particularly liturgical spaces. What does that word mean to you, and how has it kind of shifted or not shifted over the years?
Yeah. So liturgy, the kind of translation of the Greek, is closely, you know, work of the people or work for the people. And I don't know, you could think of like a Catholic rite or like an Anglican liturgical service. I think that's typically what most people think of, is kind of this structured form for communing with the divine. And so those are maybe obvious, but I think it certainly transcends, you know, a like Anglican church service or anything like that. I think it's just any kind of pattern or form for communing with the divine. I give a few examples in the preface of, like, I think, you know, I think about the Okui practice by Bantu groups. I think about something like Tai Chi and like the embodied rhythm of Tai Chi. I think there are so many different forms of like communing with the sacred that can, you know, be interpreted as liturgy. For me, I, you know, have found rest in liturgy in terms of a written form. You know, that's kind of what I deal in, but also an embodied form. You'll see there's, you know, breath practice throughout every section pretty much that reminds me that it's not all kind of cognitive, or like it's not all recitation. There's a space for the body to enter in this ritual. And over time, yeah, I appreciate that you asked how it's shifted, because I think when I first began the project, the liturgy very much was just the writing. It was just the prayer part of it, you know, and connecting it to these other poems or thoughts from other people. And I've come to see it as more of that kind of inherent translation of work of the people. So it's not necessarily the words themselves, it's not necessarily the prayers themselves. But this kind of collective energy, this collective ritual that we're practicing with a kind of dailiness, it's not always daily, but that we're practicing with a kind of dailiness, and that collective energy really being at the core of the work as opposed to my particular words, if that makes sense.
And that it does. And thank you. And that's, that made me kind of think about this book as I was going through it. How did you see people using it? Was it like for a daily practice? Was it to be used collectively? Is it both? Did you get feedback from people? And that's kind of what also guided your thoughts.
You know, I thought about both. I thought, you know, especially the first section, I think, lends itself really well. The first section is organized by, you know, we call it the existential, or these kind of experiences or stories that comprise the human experience. And I think that section lends itself to, you know, being encountered as an individual really well. I think, you know, the letters in particular, and then there's questions for contemplation at the end of each of those sections that I think lend themselves to like self-examine. But I can just as easily see them being held in community if that community is safe and, you know, comfortable. I say this in the book, you know, there are some liturgies that will just sound different with different people in the room, that will just fall in a room differently depending on how safe you feel and who's looking over your shoulder. And so I think it really is contextual with the section. You know, some section, you might get to the section on secrets and think, this is, you know, not where I would not want to encounter this in the community that I belong to. But perhaps the section on mortality, it might be enriched by having like an intergenerational voice present. So yeah, I think it depends. I certainly have an imagination for both. The second section of the book, which is organized by time or by these kind of rhythms in a year or in a month or in a week or however you want to think about it, those, there's a lot more call and response, kind of longer call and response forms that can be used. So I think that section in particular lends itself to communal spaces quite easily.
I was going to say, just a follow-up, have individuals given you feedback on how they've used, obviously the book hasn't been released yet, but just using the online content, have people said like, hey, here's how we're using it?
Yeah, I mean, I am always shocked to find that like so many churches are using it in their services. And the book, there have been a number of advanced like reader's copies. You receive them.
Yeah.
That have gone out. And it's been very encouraging to hear that, there are people that are using them in like small groups and going through the different themes weekly with each other, but taking them into kind of their own space throughout the week to kind of have that both individual and communal engagement. Exciting.
I love that. I love the idea of like a group and then also being able to do it individual. So there's like a combo experience. Yeah. That's great. Okay.
Yeah. Cause it's interesting. I feel like sometimes there's churches that are strictly community. Like it's strictly, there's no individual like assessment or anything like that. And then there's other churches who are strictly individual and have no community or like just it. Like there's no like connection to that piece. And so the reminder that it's both and that's how we, become our full selves is.
I'm just thinking in my, like, it's a great tool because I mean, right now for a lot of people, I'll speak from my own experience, like church has been kind of a difficult thing, like a church space, and something like this really allows you to practice your faith individually and then maybe find some folks collectively. And it doesn't have to be what we imagine as a church structure. Mm-hmm. And I, right now, for me, I'm like, I'm pursuing those types of things. Like I'm trying to understand what does faith look like outside of our idea of this physical church structure? And your book is an example of that.
Mm, yeah, I appreciate that because there are so many, I mean, more and more in recent months, particularly so many people who aren't Christians or don't really profess any particular spirituality that have followed the project online, and I'm kind of just I've been mystified by that for years, that there's some kind of connection that people feel to the work that isn't exclusive to any particular spirituality. And so when you kind of open it up to, I can imagine people just reading this with a group of friends. It doesn't have to be like a church small group. And my hope is that it feels accessible in the same way that the social media posts feel accessible.
So when we're looking through the titles of your book and you kind of shared that the first part of the book is maybe a little bit more for individual reflection. The second part is maybe a little more collective, but you have these themes that are the same as your first book, this here, Flesh. And so were those meant to be read in like in conjunction with each other? Are they separate? Are they just like truths you can't let go of, that they're just so central? Like what is?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of the latter of like the chapters in this here Flesh are just kind of really core truths that I can't let go of in my own spiritual formation. I've added a number of, I don't know how many sections I added. I've added to that number since, and maybe if I had the time and space, I would have made chapters on them in this here Flesh. But yeah, when I thought about this, I can in a way see people who have read this here Flesh encountering these and feeling a little more familiar, a little bit more like home to them. But I certainly don't think they, need to be read together or even, the best companions necessarily. But yeah, those themes and those kind of core stories that I think hold together what it means to be human are just very present and how I think about the world and my writing. So it made sense to kind of organize things that way.
And then the ones you've added, what was that process like? You know, there's one on love, we were saying, there's one on mortality. Like, what are those kind of the thought behind adding those ones?
Well, I think because I did such kind of grand chapters for This Year Flesh in the book tour, I've had a lot of people kind of question, like, how did you choose those chapters for This Year Flesh? And, you know, why isn't there a chapter on love? And so I've had to really ask myself those questions as other people have interrogated what sections were left out of This Year Flesh. And some I would say, yeah, that feels right to still leave out. And some I've thought, you know, I do have liturgies that I've written that fit into these categories. And I tried my best, where for This Year Flesh, I was really practicing imagination for the interior worlds of my father and my grandma. You know, those are the kind of stories that hold the thing together. With Black liturgies, I was really trying to practice imagination for the interior lives of my ancestors and of the people that are in that community, the Black liturgies community. And so I had to expand it a bit more and make room for the people I've forgotten. And, you know, my grandma, she was someone, for example, who did not want to dwell on mortality at all, couldn't get her to answer a question on mortality, you know? And so that's kind of an absent theme in This Year Flesh, where Black liturgies, I can think of several elderly people in the community, specifically on Patreon, who every time I post, they share something of their story, of their life, what it means to, you know, age and feel like you're becoming obsolete, and have really opened my eyes in that way to kind of an intergenerational voice, where by the time I went to Black liturgies, I was like, I have to have them on the page. You know, that would be, you know, an injustice and a disservice to them to have that, you know, that be a void. So yeah, it came from a lot of imagining and thinking, okay, who's actually in this community and whose voices maybe are missing within my own kind of small world or even my own familial story.
Yeah, I mean, I love what I hear is that you are engaging with those that are engaging with your work, and you're learning, you're hearing from them, and you're interacting, and they're interacting, and you know, that's relationship, you know, even if it's a virtual space, and it adds value and helps all of us grow, and that's the work I see. So that's a great reflection.
You kind of already mentioned this, but in each of the chapters, and this is true on your writing too, you lean on these like wisdom giants, from James Baldwin to Toni Morrison. What does that mean for you? Like, what is that, the cultivation of those quotes and that wisdom, how does that kind of come together? And what does that mean for you to kind of rely on that past wisdom?
Yeah. I mean, I reached a point, I don't know, I encountered, when I first started encountering Christianity, it was also the first time I was encountering a lot of Black literature for the first time. This was in college, and I, you know, had never read Toni Morrison before, had never even heard of James Baldwin. I came into college, you know, very ignorant of kind of the Black literary tradition. And so I was experiencing all of this, I don't know, this awakening, I think, in the classroom and in books. And simultaneously, it was the first time I was attending a church regularly, apart from a small stint when I was young growing up. But it was the first time I'd seriously begun attending a Christian church. And the whole of the college experience was so strange and new to me that it was very difficult for me to compartmentalize things. Like, it all was just this new world, the church and the classroom. And so I feel like, I feel like as I was kind of interpreting what I was learning in church, I was also experiencing a Black literary tradition that is very spiritual. I mean, the Black novel, you think about Toni Morrison, Zora Neale Hurston, even Richard Wright, you know, I think James Baldwin certainly all have something to say about the spiritual dimension of the human life. Of course, they're coming at it from a particular angle. They're not trying to tell you what to think or, you know, get you to profess any particular creed about what that means, but they're still addressing it. And so I think those things have always been entangled in my mind, you know. And so when I thought about liturgy that is Black, liturgy that honors Blackness, I think there have been plenty of liturgies that honor art and poems and the words of white ancestors, a white intellectual tradition. And I wanted to kind of reclaim some of the Black wisdom tradition and incorporate that in the liturgy. And I think it makes it come alive in a certain way and reminds people that, you know, nothing that I'm saying is really all that new, that it certainly didn't begin with me, that I'm descending from a long line of people who are concerned with the spiritual, are concerned with the space, the sacred, and haven't sacrificed their Blackness because of it.
How has, you know, given all of this and now with this second book, how has your faith experience or journey continued to grow or change or unwind?
I like the word unwind. If I'm honest, I feel like I experience this opening, this expanding. I'm in a pretty, you know, a pretty serious season of doubt, I would say. And now I have to find a way to market this thing that I wrote, you know, to a God while every morning I'm waking up with the news being what it is, with the state of the world being what it is. Of course, asking myself, is any of this real? Is there anyone on the other side of this conversation? And so, you know, since writing and as I was writing, I think I definitely experienced a kind of uncertainty. And what I'm trying to do, I think, in this season more than anything else is, instead of trying to resolve that uncertainty or resolve that doubt, is just ask myself, what does it mean to write a prayer book to a God that you don't know exists every day, that you wake up some days and you really question? And do these words have any merit if that's the case? And I think I've come to a place where I think yes, that even in the uncertainty of them, I think there's beauty in kind of the human desire to connect with the divine, to connect with God, even in the midst of like chaos and suffering and uncertainty, to just want to believe, to at least want to believe that there is a God, I think goes a long way. So, yeah.
You are not alone. You are not alone. Yeah, that resonates quite well.
Yeah, and thank you for being honest about that. I think so much of like my church experience has taught that doubt or uncertainty is sinful or like dark territory you don't want to go into. And instead of just being honest about it and saying, but my desire to please you does in fact please you, you know, like, or my desire to believe or whatever the thing is, it's like, the honesty is what I think keeps us human or helps us stay human.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my favorite prayer, Chelsea, the Thomas Merton one. It's I love it. It's like, I don't know where I'm going and I'm not even sure you're there, but I'll just keep putting one foot in front of the other and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, I think it does bring something alive. Like even in the uncertainty, like what you're saying, Cole, like the, I want to believe, I want to have this connection, I want someone to be on the other side. And that sometimes is enough, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just meeting the doubt with a lot of questions and compassion, and I have to believe, you know, if there is a God, which this morning I woke up feeling a little bit closer to the divine than maybe yesterday. I think it's ebbing and flowing. But, you know, if there is a God, I can only hope that they would have the emotional competency and the understanding to realize why a human and living in this particular world at this particular time would have the doubts that they do. I could only hope that they would have great compassion on that, knowing that we're witnessing so much pain and suffering. You know, if God is real and good, I would hope they would have understanding on that. As opposed to, you know, like you said, Chelsea, the the kind of toxic, like, fear-mongering around it of, oh, no, this is dark territory, you know, don't go there. I would think the divine would meet our doubts with a much different kind of voice and tone of, yeah, that makes a lot of sense that you're feeling confused and uncertain right now.
Yep.
At least I hope.
There's a part in there's parts in the book that when you're doing the collective kind of liturgies that you are always there's always a forgiveness piece. And I think there's part of me that's struggling with the forgiveness Christianity like partnership right now. And so I'm wondering if you can just talk about why it was important for you to include the forgiveness piece. What does forgiveness mean for you? How does that help us stay human?
Yeah. So, you know, in kind of traditional Anglican and Catholic liturgies, you would have, and even past that, I think you find it in lots of different church traditions, you would have the absolution, you know, after the confession, and the priest kind of absolves you of your sins. And I immediately felt discomfort with that. I have more questions than answers about the role of kind of absolution. And so I thought, okay, what's the closest thing I can approach and still feel like honest? And I thought forgiveness, because I don't think I have the ability to absolve anyone of anything. I just don't. I think we should look to the people that we've harmed in order to receive that. But I thought, is there a kind of forgiveness that can be met in these pages that is much more about forgiveness, self-forgiveness and self-compassion, and even entertaining the idea of a divine forgiveness? Is that still worthwhile? And I use this phrase, I think it's like, let your souls receive this rest. It's something along those lines before each of the forgiveness sections. Because I think ultimately that lack, and not that every conflict needs to resolve, but I think there is a kind of, I don't know, interior fatigue and interior restlessness that makes it really difficult to kind of go on in the world in the absence of some kind of repair. And I think forgiveness is something that can at least give our souls a chance at being put at rest, and gives yourself a chance at being able to face your own interior world, to be able to kind of face what Baldwin calls the tyranny of the mirror. Maybe it's not called absolution, but is there something adjacent that, you know, if there's something adjacent that feels appropriate to approach, I think that is forgiveness and that kind of compassion and rest that comes with it.
That's a good reframing. The rest of, like, not the torment, but the, like, the mind chatter that goes on when you're in conflict, or that you've hurt someone or someone's hurt you, and the ways that you can just kind of build upon anger and resentment and all that stuff, but to, like, let your soul breathe for a minute and, like, yeah. That makes sense to me. That's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for a minute, I'm glad you said that, because I don't think it's like final, or at least maybe we want to believe it is. But like, I so rarely have actually experienced forgiveness like that, where it's felt like, okay, someone's forgiven me, or I've forgiven myself, and then that's the end of it. There's still this residual guilt, this echo of the harm that I think reappears. And so can the mark of forgiveness, or the words of forgiveness, even just for a moment, can you enter the rest of forgiveness? And maybe tomorrow you'll feel, you know, racked with guilt again, but can you enter the words tomorrow and let them be restful for however long you can kind of access that self-forgiveness? Yeah.
Was there anything in the liturgy, from just your own experience with liturgy, that you left out? Like, so maybe it's absolution, but was there anything you're like, it's something I just can't, you know, put in, or it no longer serves me?
That's interesting. I mean, I've of course left song out. That's not by want. It's more out of necessity and just a lack of skill, lack of my own ability or skill, or even the ability to curate a kind of, but I hope that will be integrated and like different in particular communities in its own way. I would love to have the liturgies include music and song. And but in terms of like intentionally, and I wanted to leave it out, I suppose, you know, the first section, the first, part one of the book, there isn't as much, not all of the liturgies are grounded in scripture. And I think, of course, that's a diversion from kind of traditional Christian liturgy, where the words are more grounded in kind of Black literary texts. I might incorporate a Christian scripture or even be informed by it, but it's certainly not, you know, the architecture of the liturgy and the way that I think some kind of church liturgies are. And that was intentional in the way that how I do Black liturgies online is intentional. I want people who are maybe escaping the violence of Christian spaces, the ways that scripture has been used against Black bodies and queer bodies. And I wanted to create a kind of open space to land that isn't tied so deeply to the Bible. But if someone wanted to bring that in their own way, that they would, it would make sense. It wouldn't be, you know, outside of the norm to include a psalm here or there or whatever speaks to you. So I think that is a pretty big difference. In the second section, however, there is, of course, a lot more Christian scripture because there's a lot more of the kind of Christian liturgical timeline in that part.
Okay. Speaking of the Christian liturgical timeline, so there's like liturgy of like the structure of the service or, you know, and then there's the liturgical year, which you follow. I'm curious about the, there are some in traditional liturgical spaces there, you've had some additions. So like Mother's Day, Father's Day, Juneteenth, and I'm wondering how you kind of decided on those and, you know, just kind of like the thought process.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wish I would have added more, honestly. If there's ever volume two, I think I would have a lot more to add. But I thought about the liturgies that I had shared so far about these kind of seasonal base liturgies, and the Mother's and Father's Day ones in particular are reimagined from prior Black liturgies post. But I also tried to think of like what are the rhythms in Black life that wouldn't show up on the page or aren't going to show up in Thomas Cranmer's kind of conception of a timeline. And of course, Juneteenth is one of them. And it's a time that's more, I mean, with every year that passes is growing larger and bigger for so many communities. But I don't think Christians have the text or history to really engage it in a meaningful way. So I very boldly attempted a liturgy for Juneteenth. I thought about a funeral service, which of course there's some beautiful liturgical writings around funeral services that I wouldn't even dare to correct. But, you know, in a lot of Black spaces, we have something called homegoing celebrations, and it's, you know, a little bit distinct from a funeral. The purpose and the kind of conversations and even the activities that happen, I think, are a little bit different. And I to date have never found a liturgy for a homegoing service, and certainly not one written with the same intention and clarity as the funeral rites that you find in Catholic and Anglican tradition. So I attempted that. So yeah, it came from a lot of just reimagining and who's missing, whose timeline is missing from the stories that we typically tell.
I hope there's a part two. I want to see all the different ones you would add. That's so interesting. I love that.
What's your hope for people as they engage with this work?
I think my hope is that people, you know, put the book down feeling nearer to themselves, maybe nearer to God in some way, and feeling connected, you know, connected to this sense of community that transcends time and place. I think books have like an amazing ability to do that, to remind us that we're not alone, even if we're encountering them alone, to remember that there are people throughout history who have had the same questions, who have, you know, worn the same scars and found a way to survive and even have found joy and, you know, delight in the midst of it, I think is an incredibly powerful thing. So I hope people encounter that.
Well, Cole, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, we have been fans. We continue to cheer you on. The book comes out January 16th, so we hope that everyone listening will pick up a copy and grab a couple friends and maybe even do it in community. But Cole, thank you for today, for your words of wisdom, and thank you for the work that you put into the world. It's vulnerable and it's powerful. And so it has changed my perception, and I know that it's changing other people's also. So just thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just, we want to make sure people know how to find you, find the work. And so can you just let us, you know, tell us where do people go to engage with you and your work?
Yes. You can go to my website, which is colearthurreilly.com. Or if you're on social media, on Instagram, at Black Liturgies is the project that the book is born from. And on Twitter, which is now has another name that I don't know, but on what used to be Twitter, I am at Black Liturgist. So yeah, hope to connect with you.
Excellent. Yay! Thank you, Cole. This was wonderful. Thank you, Cole.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, it was good to be with you again.
It is good to be with you as well. Blessings to you.